I'm Peter Adamson, and you're listening to the History of Philosophy podcast, brought to you with the support of the Philosophy Department at King's College London and the LMU in Munich, online at historyofphilosophy.net. Today's episode, The Dark Knight Rises, Spanish Mysticism. There's a persistent notion that in antiquity, people never or hardly ever read silently. Instead, books were for reading aloud. I like to imagine the ancient librarians at Alexandria constantly saying, shh, amidst the cacophony, and being cheerfully ignored by the hundreds of patrons as they recited the contents of their scrolls. But sadly, this is a myth, in part based on a misreading of a passage in Augustine, where he describes seeing his colleague Ambrose reading quietly, and is apparently surprised at this. In fact, he's just concerned over Ambrose's state of mind. True, given the scarcity of books and frequency of illiteracy, reading aloud for the benefit of others was presumably far more common back then, but there's plenty of evidence that the ancients read quietly, the way we do. Plotinus even mentions the all-too-familiar phenomenon of having your mind wander while your eyes are scanning down a page so that you don't register what you are reading. Perhaps the reason people cherish the idea of silent reading as a more recent phenomenon is that it fits so well with other ideas we have about modernity. As we've seen, a new kind of individualism is widely thought to have emerged around the time of the Reformation, with Erasmus and the Protestants promoting a private internal spirituality at the cost of public and communal religious ritual. Hamlet, that archetypal tragic hero of individualism, is even sometimes depicted brooding as he reads a book. So it fits with our preconceptions that another debate about silence emerged some decades before Shakespeare wrote his play in the context of 16th century Spain. It concerned not reading, but prayer. Early in the century, a reform movement among Franciscans encouraged what they called recollection. For historians of philosophy, this sounds like an allusion to Plato and his theory that apparent learning is in fact recollection of knowledge that is already in the soul. But the Franciscans meant something different by it, that the soul should withdraw into itself, away from worldly things, in order to discover God. One of the methods they encouraged was daily meditation, spending 1.5 hours each day in what was called mental prayer. This kind of silent devotional practice made some people nervous. Never reluctant about criticizing their Franciscan rivals, the Dominicans came out in favor of praying aloud. The Inquisition took an interest too, because silent prayer was associated with the suspect group of so-called illuminated ones, or alumbrados, a group we've had occasion to mention before. Critics of the alumbrados and their individualist approach worried that in solitude and silence, we become more vulnerable to suggestion and deception from the devil. That's a threat that doesn't bother us much nowadays, at least outside of horror movies, but is vividly demonstrated by the contemporary outbreak of paranoia about witchcraft. Demonic influence was a paramount concern in the 16th century. Like the practice of reading silently, this fear went back to antiquity, when the desert fathers, who retreated to pray in the wilderness, spoke of their struggles against demonic attack, along with more quotidian concerns like bodily desires, starvation, and good old-fashioned boredom. It was also a fear with philosophical resonance. You don't have to be a desert father or Spanish inquisitor to wonder about the stray thoughts that come to us unbidden, especially in quiet moments when we're trying to concentrate, be at peace, or just relax. Are these thoughts trustworthy insights? Mere figments of a mind that refuses to be quiet? Or worse still, the whisperings of sinister forces that lie hidden within us, or as these Christians worried, are trying to seduce us from without? In short, can you trust the workings of your own mind when it is left to its own devices? Despite anxieties about the devil and the Inquisition, a small literature of private spirituality started to emerge in Spain, initiated by figures like a Franciscan named Bernardino of Laredo. A pioneer in the theory of recollection, he proposed a range of techniques for pursuing mystical insight, including silent prayer and meditation on images, like the crucifixion of Christ. As if this were not provocative enough, he may have been of converso stock. And even if he wasn't, the fact that he studied medicine and associated with known conversos would have made him suspect. He managed to stay out of trouble, though, by carefully appealing to influential church figures to approve his writings before publishing them. This pattern of seeking institutional permission for disseminating daring ideas would repeat itself with a more famous author, one who was influenced by Bernardino, Teresa of Avila. She joins the ranks of great female mystics who have graced our story, from Hildegard of Bingen in the 12th century to Julian of Norwich and Marjorie Kemp in the early 15th century. Like all of them, Teresa faced an obvious obstacle to disseminating her ideas. She was a woman. In her case, this was a particular hindrance, since women were thought to be more vulnerable to influence from the devil than men. In fact, Teresa herself is willing to admit that women are especially susceptible to such influence. This exemplifies a rhetorical strategy familiar to us from other women writers, as she paradoxically gets the reader to trust her authority as a writer by modestly renouncing any claim to authority. But Teresa is also acknowledging what the reader would already be thinking. The Alumbrados counted several women among their number, especially Isabel de la Cruz and Maria de Casala, both arrested by the Inquisition. Then there were celebrated cases of fraudulent female mystics, like Maria de la Visitacion, a Lisbon nun who faked ecstasies and stigmata, and Magdalena de la Cruz, who claimed to receive visionary trances, but then admitted she had not. Teresa, too, reported having ecstatic visions and even experienced miraculous phenomena like spontaneous levitation. When Teresa claimed to have both her soul and her body raised up supernaturally, suspicions naturally arose, too. This provides the context for her most important work, an account of her experiences that was, somewhat misleadingly, labeled as an autobiography by its editor, none other than Fray Luis de León. She wrote it on command, so that it could be determined whether her experiences are sent by God or by the devil. Teresa mentions this context of writing herself, cleverly using it as a kind of excuse or permission to set her ideas before the reader, given that, as she knows all too well, she does not have the authority to write. Her self-presentation as an author is double-sided. On the one hand, she's absolutely convinced that she has indeed enjoyed a special connection to God, and says that her long experience with spiritual development gives her a degree of assurance that might be lacking to beginners. At one point, she says bluntly, "I have been through all this, and so I know it." At another point, she admits that the devil has tried to tempt her 3 or 4 times, but she knew what was happening because anyone who has had a true vision from God will detect a false one almost immediately. At the same time, even in the same passages, she emphasizes that she also benefits from the guidance of male advisors, usually those who served as her confessors. Addressing one of them in the book, she instructs that anything foolish, she writes, should be struck out, and elsewhere even says that the whole work should be destroyed if it conflicts with the teachings of the church. Above all, she is relentlessly, and to all appearances sincerely, humble. When he treated the book as her life story, Fray Luis was presumably thinking above all of the early parts, in which Teresa laments her formerly sinful ways, which were especially inexcusable given that she had the advantage of pious parents and of high social standing. She was, for instance, prepared to be shocked by her youthful indiscretions given to reading chivalric romances. Born in Avila in 1515, Teresa was yet another thinker with a converso background, since her grandfather had been brought before the Inquisition as a Judaizer in 1485. But this doesn't seem to have been known when her potentially controversial works were disseminated. When she was 15, she was placed in an Augustinian convent, where she was, by her own account, not very good at the whole being a nun business, constantly distracted and overly interested in superficialities. After a brush with death so near that wax was put on her eyes in preparation for her burial, she started to become the Teresa we meet in the autobiography, with a crucial step being a move to a Carmelite convent in 1536. The Carmelites are an order, not unlike the Franciscans, which was founded in Jerusalem in the 13th century. In due course, inspired by the spiritual reform of the Franciscans, Teresa would lead reformist efforts among the Carmelites. Her faction was called discalced, literally unshod, in other words, barefoot, a sign of their intense ascetic commitment. Teresa spent much of her mature life traveling around Spain, founding new houses for the order that would observe rigorous rules of conduct. It has been observed that for women, this movement played something like the role that the Jesuits played for men. In addition to recounting and justifying all this, the autobiography gives us some indication of Teresa's sources. As you might already have guessed, this story of early waywardness and developing piety is in part inspired by Augustine's Confessions. Like Augustine's work, Teresa's is framed autobiographically, but is really a depiction of the soul's journey toward an appropriate relationship with God. Another author who had a powerful effect on Teresa was the Franciscan friar Francisco de Osuna, whose writings reached Teresa thanks to her uncle. Osuna exemplifies the spiritualist and reformist movement I already described. He was in favor of silent prayer, recollection, and what he called self-abandonment. Particularly enticing for Teresa must have been Osuna's contrast between two kinds of theology. On the one hand, there's the speculative science of those who are learned, the letrados, like university schoolmen. On the other hand, there's the mystic or hidden theology that is pursued through virtue and love of God. As a woman, inevitably excluded from pursuing theology of the first kind, one can imagine Teresa embracing Osuna's mystical path as the only way to pursue her heartfelt piety. In fact, she almost says as much, remarking that books are only a substitute to be used by those who aren't yet capable of mental prayer. And in a passage that displays her typical combination of tenacious self-confidence and ostentatious modesty, Teresa says, "The safest thing is to follow the course that I do. If I did not, I should have no peace. Not that it is right for us women to have peace, since we have no learning." One reason that I take Teresa's frequent declarations of humility to be sincere is that she sees this attitude as the best defense against the devil. His evil machinations are effective in those who trust in themselves rather than in God and the church. Thus, humility is more useful than knowledge, and individual striving less useful than trust in God. As she puts it, all efforts are useless without God's grace. On the other hand, she is convinced that God will grant his aid to all who honestly seek it, which puts some distance between her theology and what the Protestants were saying. In keeping with this, her advice for achieving mystical union with God is primarily negative. Our aim should be to orient our will towards the divine and let the other powers of the soul slip into a kind of quiet inactivity. Failing that, they may carry out automatic and independent background activity that doesn't impinge on the mystic's awareness, something she compares to the motion of the shadow cast by a sundial. This is one of the richest seams in Teresa's book for those looking to mine philosophical gold. She takes over Augustine's description of the soul as having, or even consisting of, three powers, namely will, memory, and intellect. What her long practice in meditation and silent prayer has enabled her to achieve is a kind of freedom from mental activity. She has managed to stop the restless flitting of her thought from one thing to another, like a moth drawn to different lights. The intellect in particular is, she says, like a raving lunatic, which dwells incessantly on matters of total irrelevance, meaning anything other than God. But once these capacities are rendered inactive, one can receive spiritual gifts unbidden, as if one's stomach were filled without eating. For example, one may suddenly understand theological matters like the Trinity so plain to the soul that it will boldly argue against any theologian in defense of these miraculous truths. Again, none of this is the soul's own doing. No effort of ours makes us see more or less, or calls up or dispels a vision. Thus, she is skeptical about the practice of meditating on images, for instance, mentally picturing Christ. That might be all right for beginners, but it is an indirect method that will inevitably be undermined by wandering attention. Teresa's emphasis on psychic inactivity may seem to show that her mystical theory is one of complete passivity. That could also be encouraged by the theme of rapture, which many may associate with Teresa, thanks to the famous depiction of her by the great Baroque sculptor Gian Lorenzo Bernini. It is based on a passage in her book in which she describes being pierced through with a spear wielded by an angel. In the sculpture, Teresa's head is thrown back, her mouth open, and eyes half closed. The artistic rendering brings out the obvious erotic connotations of the text. But this passage is not particularly representative. In fact, it's the only such moment in the whole book. Despite her youthful enthusiasm for romance literature, reading Teresa is not at all like reading medieval mystics like Hadewijch, whose project was to borrow the themes of courtly love poetry for use in mystical writing. Then too, understanding Teresa's mystical experience as a passive ravishment would ignore the crucial role of the third power of the soul, the will. Her goal is not just to turn the soul off, as it were, but to focus its whole attention on God. A more rationalist thinker, perhaps one of those schoolmen, might think of this in terms of intellectual contemplation, but Teresa disagrees, writing, "The intellect is of no value here." Her idea seems to be that the intellect is always grasping some idea or representation of something or other, whereas the will can have an immediate relationship with God, something she understands as a kind of abiding peace. Insofar as the intellect remains engaged at all, it is no longer reasoning, but just enjoying God, like a spectator who doesn't know where to look. Teresa is keenly aware that this could sound to some readers like an endorsement of the spiritualist approach of the illuminated ones or alumbrados, so she addresses the problem directly. In another use of humility to deflect criticism, she admits that she isn't really sure what the alumbrados believe, but supposes that they are people devoted to spiritual progress, which sounds fine to her. They are spiritual men and learned and know what they are saying. But she cannot go along with their claims to escape embodied life completely. It is madness to try to be an angel already in this life, since our thoughts must have something to support them. In part thanks to such strategically moderate statements, Teresa managed to avoid the sort of outright condemnation that was visited upon the alumbrados. Admittedly, she was denounced to the Inquisition at least 6 times, which shows that she struck many as a problematic and provocative figure. Her emphasis on voluntary poverty, along with her claims about mystical and supernatural experiences, would have seemed troubling, but the heaviest sanction taken against her was merely to prevent the circulation of her book. One of her confessors, the Dominican friar Domingo Bañez, examined it and pronounced it free of heresy, yet also at risk of corrupting some readers. Visions, he warned, should always be feared, especially in women who are more likely to believe they come from God and to see holiness in them. Teresa was disappointed. For all her humility, she did want others to benefit from her experiences. She responded by writing other books, including The Way of Perfection. It pointedly notes that women may actually have an advantage over the learned, who do not take so much notice of things that in themselves seem trivial. Fortunately, Teresa didn't necessarily need to find readers to win adherents. Her indefatigable efforts on behalf of the Carmelite reform movement took her all around Spain, and she encountered and inspired many who chose to follow her path. No one was more powerfully affected than the man who, after making that choice, took the name Juan de la Cruz, in English, John of the Cross. Born in 1542, John enjoyed a humanist education, possibly including courses in philosophy, at one of the newly founded Jesuit colleges. He became a Carmelite monk in 1563, then studied in Salamanca, where he most definitely encountered philosophy. His momentous meeting with Teresa came only in 1567, and he became a passionate advocate for her reform movement. His reward was to be put under house arrest by his fellow Carmelites in 1577, but after some months, he escaped out a window using bedsheets as a ladder. Such exploits aside, his contribution to Teresa's legacy was that his educational background enabled him to add a scholarly, and indeed scholastic, perspective to her brand of piety and mysticism. As we'll see in an upcoming episode, the ideas of Thomas Aquinas were especially influential among Jesuits and other Catholic thinkers of the period, and that applies to John too. For example, while he does apply an Augustinian psychology to analyze mystical union, as Teresa had done, he takes from Aquinas a rationalist position according to which the will follows the dictates of the intellect. But no one would mistake John for a typical scholastic. Among his extensive writings, those that most stand out are a pair of treatises in which he comments at great length on a poem of his own authorship. Despite his prolixity, in neither case does his commentary get to the end of the poem. The first treatise is called The Ascent of Mount Carmel, referring to the landmark in modern-day Israel that gave the Carmelite order its name. The second is called The Dark Knight, as in Dark Knight of the Soul, not as in the cape crusading defender of Gotham City. The image of the Dark Knight already arises in The Ascent, where John explains that it represents the extinguishing of worldly desires. Holy asceticism, Batman! In one of several passages where he explicitly cites Aristotle and the other philosophers, John adds that, since two contraries cannot exist in the same subject, the soul cannot simultaneously orient itself towards the natural and the supernatural. Echoing Teresa's warning against the overly spiritualizing alumbrados, John warns that it is not possible to eliminate all our desires, since we remain embodied natural beings, but those that are under our control should be minimized and ultimately laid to rest. As John puts it in some famous lines, suggesting that his favorite supervillain would have been the Riddler, to reach satisfaction in all, desire satisfaction in nothing. To come to possess all, desire the possession of nothing. To arrive at being all, desire to be nothing. To come to the knowledge of all, desire the knowledge of nothing. Like Teresa, John offers a psychological account of how this happens in terms of certain faculties or powers. Since, as just mentioned, the will and memory follow the intellect, we should in the first instance focus on darkening the intellect, which John says is the work of faith. Faith in God is nothing other than the blinding of the rational soul, stripping away what we have learned through the senses, indeed everything that is other than God. This is a painful process because it alienates the soul from everything it has habitually wanted and loved, something John describes as a kind of purging or burning away of sensory experience and desire. Just as a piece of wood is gradually destroyed and transformed into fire, so the human soul is gradually consumed with agonizing love and unified with God. Borrowing a metaphor also used by Teresa, John says that the soul is dry when it is in this transitional state, getting consolation neither from the world nor from God. To make matters worse, there's no guarantee of enjoying the union with God that is the mystical practitioner's only desire. It is simply a mystery that some are granted this vision and others not. While much of this is taken over from Teresa, albeit with added technical and terminological details, John seems to go beyond her in his commitment to negative theology. Certainly, this is consistent with her thought, which, as we saw, involves shutting down the activity of intellect to make room for God. But John really emphasizes this idea, explaining that in the mystical union, we will think nothing, no pensar nada. In a handmade drawing of the symbolic ascent up the mountain that John included in his text, there's a trail marked with the Spanish word nada, nothing, repeated over and over. As a much later philosopher would put it, that whereof one cannot speak, one must be silent. But that's not an option for us, since this is, after all, an audio podcast, so next time we're going to move on to a group who have already been making cameo appearances in our story, the Jesuits. Which may sound like an abrupt transition, since the Jesuits are more famous as teachers and missionaries than for any spiritual or mystical enterprise. But actually, this sequence of topics makes perfect sense. As we'll be seeing, the founder of the order, Ignatius of Loyola, fits remarkably well into the story just told in this episode, to the point that his classic writing, The Spiritual Exercises, can take a place alongside the autobiography of Teresa and the double treatise of John of the Cross to form a trinity of great Spanish mystical works. And Loyola's ideas, no less than Teresa's, were at first considered rather suspect. Ultimately, though, both would be embraced by the church. In fact, both of them were canonized on the same day, March 12, 1622. So join me next time as another saint comes marching in, as we turn to Ignatius of Loyola and the Jesuits here on The History of Philosophy Without Any Gaps.